Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to the Steps to Investing podcast, your home for stock market news and ideas to help you beat high inflation by getting you investing for a better return. I'm Marcus De Silva. And on to this week's show, we've got a pension expert, Tom Selby, who is going to be giving us some tips for growing our pension pots. We're also going to be speaking about boosting our pots if you're a little bit older, as well as having a good update from the industry on the latest news on pensions, including whether there are any impacts from the mini budget and also the autumn statement. In markets, we've got a couple of big stories there really around COVID restrictions in China and oil prices falling a little bit this week below $80 a barrel. In our explainer, we're going to have a little look at discounts in the investment trust sector and explain exactly what we mean by premiums and discounts and why these are quite unique to investment trusts. And then in companies, we've got the major headlines for you, including on companies Theranos, Wirecard, JP Morgan, and Twitter. Please, please share this with friends if you're enjoying the pod so we can get the message out there. And many thanks to our sponsors, Janus Henderson Investors, for their support, helping us educate and inform private investors. Okay, let's start with the markets. And I'm going to whip all the way around the world to the Far East first. And the big news there, which is that China has finally relaxed its position on COVID and its zero COVID policies. So at the beginning of the fortnight, there were concerns amongst investors rising. They could see COVID cases mounting there, and there were fresh expectations basically that authorities would then move to implement another wave of really harsh lockdown measures, which was having this enormously crippling impact on the economy. Well, so it was having a big impact on the economy. It's having a big impact, obviously, on China's citizens and their freedoms. And it's having a big impact on companies elsewhere in the globe as well, from luxury fashion to tech giants like Apple. The impact was crippling supply chains. It was creating these log jams, which was obviously not just creating supply issues for businesses, but also fueling some of those inflationary fires as well. So that's not good. And just to outline how big an impact it was having on China, we saw some data recently that sort of painted the picture quite vividly. So there was some manufacturing and services data that showed activity falling to its lowest level since April. We also saw some import data that showed in November, compared to where it was a year ago, imports had dropped by 10.6%. And that was against a forecast of a 6% drop. So not only was it bad, but it was much worse than what analysts thought. And then we also saw some export data as well, and that dropped in November, year on year, 8.7% against a forecast of 3.5%. So again, another bad drop against what analysts had forecast. So pretty bad data there. And then what happened in China was that finally the citizens made clear that they'd had enough. And we saw this unprecedented wave of protests begin, some violent, China's citizens took to the streets to vent their anger over these really harsh policies. Some of the observers watching this as well were quite concerned. They were worried about how the authorities might react to the process. But eventually, what they've done is relent, and they've relaxed these rules. There was a meeting of the big, powerful Politburo, the Communist Party's decision-making body, who, you know, the official line was that they agreed the economy needed now a much bigger focus than COVID, and that they needed to relax some of these rules. So what we've seen is now they're going to allow quarantining at home, for example, and also they're dropping the need for lots of negative tests when you go everywhere, including when you're traveling to other regions. Now, you would have expected the market to react quite positively to that. You know, it's something we've spoken about a lot. As I say, it's been one of these factors that's been fueling global inflation. But actually, it's sort of been a bit of toing and froing in the Shanghai index market in China. And I think that's because the concerns of before have been replaced by new ones, really. Namely that, well, its economic woes are not going to be repaired that quickly. It's going to take some time. But also, how is the country now going to cope given these newfound freedoms, given the rate of vaccinations there? You know, and if infections spike, well, are we just going to see healthcare systems become overrun and authorities needing to lock down people anyway? So I think there's sort of some unanswered questions about how China will cope with this, which is sort of restraining some of the bulls in the market a little bit. I think the other big story at the moment is oil. So we saw that this week it dipped below $80 a barrel, which is pretty low. It's lowest level since January. Now, it's interesting, really, because there's sort of forces working in both ways in the oil market at the moment. It's very complex, as our analyst Keshav described some months ago on the pod. But I think the big thing is that, about a week ago, I think observers were thinking, oh, we might see a bit of a spike in the price of oil, because what we're going to have introduced soon is this price cap from the West on Russian oil. So that was introduced this week, the $60 price cap, as a way of trying to curtail these excess profits that Russia is probably taken from spikes in the energy market caused by its war in Ukraine, and therefore giving it funds in order to be able to fund that further. So they're trying to curtail that. But so how they're doing it? Well, Russian oil can't be shipped by EU or G7 tankers unless it's below the price limit. So that's how they're trying to sort of get around it, is that just they won't allow Russia to use its ships to transport it. That's one of the things about Russian oil is it often needs to be transported by ships. There's not many pipelines to do it directly. Now, Russia has vowed to circumvent these by using other leased tankers. There aren't that many, though. So the expectation might be that this would crimp supply, and therefore that might, you know, push up the price of oil. Well, actually, the market forces have really been working much more strongly the other way. And I think the big things are that investors are thinking, they're concerned about China's demand for energy. It's a big thunderous consumer of energy, and where we are at the moment, for the reasons I described before, they're not quite sure where its new approach to COVID will take the economy, whether it'll lead to, you know, greater demand again as the economy picks up. They're not quite sure at the moment, so there's a question mark over that. And I think also, you know, the rest of the world is facing downturns in their economies, which obviously always weakens the amount of energy that's required. And recently we've seen data that shows inflation is still not really abating. Therefore, central banks are going to keep their interest rate hikes going, which means those downturns are still very likely. So that's all pushing downwards on the price of oil. So I think that's why it sort of dropped below $80 this week. Over in the US, and the latest jobs report there shows that unemployment is actually at a 50-year low. Now, of course, in a real sense, that's good to hear that people are in jobs and they're not losing their jobs yet. But for inflation, it's not so good. The bun fight for workers, as companies try to attract them, will add pressure on firms to compete over wages. So that then feeds into the inflation equation, really. So because of that kind of data, it's sort of fueled some Wall Street fears that, yeah, the Fed is not going to give up anytime soon on its mission to stamp out inflation, and that actually at its next meeting next week we might see another big 0.75% increase, rather than what the market had sort of come to expect in recent times and recent weeks, which was about 0.5%. So that's just sort of tipped the market in another gear downwards, really. And in the UK, well, it is the Christmas of discontent. We're seeing wide-ranging strikes here, as I'm sure you are all aware of. And that's, of course, adding issues to our economy on top of the cost of living crisis. Most recently, we heard RMT, the rail union, announcing more strikes over Christmas. So this is really creating headaches for certain businesses, particularly in retail and hospitality, and adding to the pressure on the economy, really. We've heard some pretty grim predictions from, you know, various institutions like the Bank of England, but more recently, the Confederation of British Industry, a trade body, which said, yeah, we're going to have a year-long recession, but then we also face a period of stagflation. It's one of these portmanteaus, which is basically this idea that we'll have low growth but elevated inflation for some time, and which is sort of very dreary for an economy. And they've said, you know, significant investment is sort of needed to unlock us out of that. So still not great, really. We're still in the midst of a bear market. Not so great at the moment. All told, the FTSE 100 is still up slightly, 0.3% to 7,492 points. The S&P 500 is down 2.29% to 3,934 points. Europe's Stoxx 600 is down 1.27% to 435 points. And Japan's Nikkei 225 is down 2.85% to 27,574 points. Okay, moving on. I was in the little explainer section today. I thought we'd have a little look at investment trust premiums and discounts. So I was having a look around the investing world. It is an interesting place if you are a bit contrarian, if you like the idea of picking up some investing assets at a cheap price, then, you know, that's the kind of time we're in. It's not to say things won't get worse. They very much might. But still, we you know, relative to history, it does seem we're at a pretty low point in terms of how cheap assets are. And one of the areas I was looking at was investment trusts. These are fantastic DIY investor product. We talk about them a fair bit on the podcast. They come with features that make them a little bit more complex and risky, but once you understand those, I think you people often love them. You know, they definitely have very, very strong and lifelong advocates. One of the things that emerged was, so there's a trade body called the Investment the Association of Investment Companies, the AIC, and they have different sectors for different things, like UK, you know, income from shares, for example, is one of their sectors, UK equity income. So when you look across all their sectors, it's emerged that 37 out of the 38 sectors, so all but one, are on the shares of those sectors on average are on a discount. So, you know, they're basically getting involved in the Black Friday craze just like the rest of us. So I thought I'd explain quickly what I mean by that, or remind you at least. You know, investment trusts have a number of features, as I mentioned, that make them quite unique, that can make them really attractive for DIY investors, but also a little bit complex. I think their big advantage is that they can gear, they can borrow extra money, much like you would a mortgage, in order to make extra investments. So that's one of their features, gearing. Another one is that they have an independent board looking after shareholder interests, which other, you know, open-ended funds do not have. And one of the things boards do is they really beat the fund managers up on costs, which is often why investment trusts are quite attractive in terms of the fees that they charge. A third one is they have a revenue reserve, so they can stash some income from, you know, good years, you know, when dividends maybe are really juicy. They can stash a little bit of that away, up to 15%. And therefore, when the years are less good, they can top that up. So that enables them just to smooth the kind of payments that are made out to investors if you're an income-seeking investor. The final one is premiums and discounts. And these can be an advantage. They're definitely a feature that you kind of have to get used to. And The reason for premiums and discounts is because investment trusts have a fixed number of shares that are traded on an exchange. So with a normal fund, when you go to invest, shares are created, and when you directly with a fund manager, and then when you go to take your money out, those shares are cancelled and your money is handed back to you. With an investment trust, it's kind of separate, not completely, but it's separate. And those shares, when you want to invest, you buy shares in the trust of another investor through an exchange. So it's a different mechanism that means the price of those shares can rise either above the value of the underlying investments or below them. Of course, the main thing that drives the value of the shares is the value of the underlying assets, the things that the fund manager is investing in. But there can be these times where there are discrepancies, and where if there's a lot of demand for that particular trust and people really want those shares, then the value of the share price can go to a premium above the value of the underlying assets. And if there's other times when people really, you know, are not wanting those shares, and there lots of people are selling them because they just don't want to be in not just that trust, but maybe that sector, then because there's so little demand for them, then what you can see is the share prices fall to a discount to the underlying investments. So that creates more volatility in the price. So that's where, you know, people talk about the added risk with investment trust. But it also can create opportunities, because of course, if you buy into the trust and the discount narrows, then you get an extra kicker to your returns, which it can add then to the returns that you would gain from the value of the underlying investments rising as well. So it can create these opportunities sometimes that can give you a bit of an extra return. Now, because we're in the middle of a bear market globally, and things are pretty dreary, then investors generally are dumping assets that are deemed riskier. So there's been a lot of selling, and what we've seen is lots of the AIC sector discounts widening. So the average discount across all the sectors has grown by more than 10%. So if you are the sort of person who is a bit contrarian, doesn't mind bucking the trend, you know, is really thinking long term as you should be, and is really seeing times like these as an opportunity to get some bargains, then with 37 of those 38 sectors all on discounts, it could be the potential to pick up some bargains. There are other factors that play a part, of course, in what creates discounts. Some sectors are permanently on a discount, and that's usually for more technical reasons, like the assets are a bit more illiquid in that particular sector, so they tend to permanently trade on a discount. So you know, you need to consider things like that. Generally have a look at the history of where the discount is. You know, if it's long-term averages minus 5% and it's on minus 10, then that might signal something that's more of a bargain. But that, of course, then it will vary from trust to trust, and you still need to do all your normal research that you would do when you're choosing an investment trust. So looking at charges, looking at performance, looking at the fund manager, looking at the strategy, and making sure that's right for your financial goals. And I think final thing just to say, if you are having a looking around at these, make sure you keep them wrapped up in your government incentivized tax wrappers like your ISAs and SIPs. You know, we've seen a bit of a raid on dividends and capital gains. So, you know, and that's going to kick in and get worse over the next few years. So make sure you've got your investments wrapped up, so that it can steer clear of any of those things. If you want more on these discounts, also on the changes that Chancellor Jeremy Hunt made in the autumn statement, then there's more on the website steps2investing.com. Okay, finally, some headlines for you. First up, we heard that the former chief operating officer of diagnostics company Theranos Sonny Balwani has received 13 years for his part in the company's fraud alongside the founder of the company, Elizabeth Holmes. They claimed that their machine, this little new machine, could detect all manner of diseases from just a few finger pricks worth of blood. So it was meant to be really revolutionary. Turned out they were lying. They were actually using machines that were already commercially available from competitors, and that they weren't using this new little machine. They hadn't actually managed to get the technology to work. So it was pretty bad. It misled some pretty high-profile investors, including the Walton family and Rupert Murdoch included there. In another headline about more badly behaved executives, we saw the trial starting with Marcus Brown, Wirecard's former chief executive, following a big fraud there, some fraudulent financial reporting basically that led to the company's dissolution, which was an enormous shame. It was a massive European fintech success story. At one point it was worth $24 billion, and it turned out to be a massive scandal in Germany, which sort of left egg on the face of various different institutions who were pretty incensed by it all, including the German government, its regulators, BaFin, and many well-known investors. They all got hoodwinked. Over on Wall Street, and the banks are not really painting a rosy economic outlook as it stands. We heard JP Morgan Chase's CEO, Jamie Dimon, warning of a pretty bumpy economic road ahead, leading to recession next year. We heard that Morgan Stanley have laid off 2% of their workforce, and that's thought to be due to a fall in deal making, considering that the sort of pandemic boom is now firmly in the rearview mirror. And it comes as we've heard of layoffs from Goldman Sachs and also Citigroup as well. So yeah, there's sort of the finance sector really responding to these tougher times. And finally, Twitter. So I mean, like, I think you'd have to have your head buried in sand if you've not been hearing lots about Twitter in recent times. Certainly since Elon Musk has taken over, there has been a pretty constant stream of news flow on Twitter, and the latest is that it may raise the price of its Twitter Blue subscription product to $11 from $7.99 if it's bought through the iPhone app directly through, rather than directly through the site, which is an interesting one, and it's a likely pushback. I mean, Musk has been sort of trying to take aim at Apple a little bit recently, I'm sure will be interesting for the rest of us, but it's a likely pushback against Apple's 30% cut that it takes on payments via its apps. So that's interesting, and it's sort of not surprising. There's been a series of tweets from Elon recently, who's clearly unhappy with elements of how Apple do business, and probably this control that they have over their ecosystem, over apps, and these very strong streams of revenues really that they can take. Interesting stuff there. Okay, on to our interview. This week we are going to be discussing pensions with Tom Selby. I'm going to hand it over to me. So it's been a little while since we've had a chat about pensions. Now, these are probably one of, if not the most important financial goal you will ever set yourself. So it's good to revisit these every now and again. They can be a bit complex. Changes in the market are definitely in abundance. So I like to bring on an expert in this field. And we've got back onto the podcast the head of pension policy from AJ Bell to chat us through what's been going on and the latest. So a very warm welcome to Tom Selby. Tom, welcome.
Hi, Marcus. Good to be on.
Great to have you on. So shall we start? I think it's always good to sort of like to start with some of the basics. And
yeah.
I thought maybe just the three main types of pension. Do you want to just remind us what those are?
Yeah. So I guess there are broadly three places that people are likely to get some sort of pension income from in their lifetime. So the first place would be the state pension. So that's the foundation usually upon which people's retirement plans are built. So you'll be entitled to a state pension payment of from next year, actually, it'll be just over £10,000 a year if you build up enough national insurance contributions to get that state pension. So you need to have 35-year national insurance record in order to qualify for the full state pension, and then you'll get a bit less for every year less of national insurance you've got. So that's the foundation. The next pillar, if you will, is the workplace. So workplace pensions, where if you are employed, then you'll be automatically enrolled into a workplace pension, and you should get at least 8% of qualifying earnings paid into that pension scheme, although a lot of employers are more generous. So it's worth asking to make sure you're getting the most of those matched contributions. And then the final bit is the private pension sector. So things like self-invested personal pensions or SIPs, where people can benefit from higher levels of flexibility, as well as the tax relief that's on offer as well, and greater kind of freedom and choice over how they save and invest their money. So those are probably the three types of pension that most people will come into contact with. There's different types within the different sectors. So in the workplace, for example, some people are lucky enough to still have defined benefit pensions. We also have defined benefit pensions in the public sector, of course, but those are broadly the three categories that people may or may not be familiar with.
And just on those sort of workplace private pensions, when we say tax relief, what do we mean by that?
So tax relief is just effectively the bonus that the government gives you for locking away your money until the age of 55. So that's the earliest that someone in a defined contribution scheme can access their pension. That's going to go up to 57 in 2028, but 55 at the moment. So if you pay £80 into a SIP, then you'll automatically get £20 added to it via tax relief. So that tops up to £100. So if you're a basic rate taxpayer, then that £20 is equivalent to the 20% tax that you would normally pay. Then if you're a higher on additional rate taxpayer, then of course you'll be paying 40 or even 45% tax, and you'll be able to claim that extra tax relief back from the revenue. That's the case if you're making those contributions via personal pensions or SIPs. It's possible if you're making those contributions in the workplace, you might be in what's called a net pay pension scheme, which just means that your contribution comes directly out of your salary before income tax has been taken off. So where that's the case, you'll get any tax relief you're owed automatically, provided, of course, you are at least a basic rate income tax payer. If you're not a base rate income tax payer and in your net pay scheme, it's possible that you'll be missing out on that valuable tax relief. That's a slightly different issue. It's one that the government said it's going to address, although it's going to take a few years for it to address that problem of lower earners in net pay schemes not getting the tax relief that they're necessarily owed.
Okay, so the tax advantages are that, you know, similar to an ISA, you're sort of protected from lots of taxes that you might need to pay on capital gains or dividend income, things like that. But also on top of that, they're very generous because you have tax relief. So the government's sort of giving you that tax that you would have paid on your earnings back so that you can use it in the stock markets to grow your money. But at the other end, when you start to draw on your pension, you do potentially face some taxes then, am I right?
So you'll get taxed on the majority of your withdrawal. So focusing on defined contribution pensions, because that's where most people are building up their pension pot. So a quarter of your pot from age 55 at the moment, as I said, that normal minimum pension age where you can access your pot is going up to 57 in 2028. At the moment, it's 55. A quarter of your pot is available tax-free, and then the rest, so the remaining 75%, will be taxed in the same way as your income is taxed. So it often makes sense to try to drip feed your withdrawals once you come to take an income from your pension, because that can mean you can minimize your income tax liability from your pension rather than taking the whole lot out in one go, potentially paying too much in tax, and of course, potentially running the risk of running out of money later on in life as well.
Tom, actually, do you want to just quickly explain the difference between defined contribution and defined benefit schemes?
Sure, yeah. So a defined contribution pension scheme is simply where you build up a pot of money that's invested in stocks and shares and funds. You may get a matched employer contribution to go into that, as well as upfront pensions tax relief, of course. And then once you reach retirement, you've got that pot of money. It's up to you to turn that pot of money into an income. So you've got all the responsibility for delivering that income, all the responsibility for building up that pot of money, and you've got lots of flexibility and choice that goes in there. So that's broadly how defined contribution pensions work. Defined benefit pensions, which are all but extinct in the private sector, although remain the main type of pension within the public sector. In defined benefit schemes, it's the employer that takes on responsibility for paying you a guaranteed income when you reach a set retirement date. So you'll work for that employer for a certain number of years. You'll be a member of the pension scheme for a certain number of years. And each year you're a member of a pension scheme, you'll build up a certain fraction of those years in order to define what your retirement income is going to be. So, for example, you might be a member of a 60th final salary pension scheme, and you might be a member of that pension scheme for 30 years. So, what that means is that if you're a member of that pension scheme for 30 years, you'll get 30 60ths or half of your final salary as a guaranteed income. Pension income for the rest of your life. Now, there's a different type of pension scheme that's also quite common nowadays, which is called a career average defined benefit pension scheme. Again, works in a very similar way. So for each year you're a member of that scheme, you'll earn a fraction of you'll earn a certain percentage as your pension income. So if we think of a 60th scheme, again, someone who's a member for 30 years, again, that would mean they'd have half of their income as half of their working income as a retirement income, but it would be half of their income, their earnings across the average of their career rather than the final salary. So it can be a little more complicated in defined benefit world, but essentially it's that your employer takes on responsibility for paying your pension income there, whereas in defined contribution, it's very much up to you to generate your own retirement income.
Okay, well, I just wondered, you know, if you are a young person listening to this podcast, are there any tips that you have around pension saving?
I mean, it depends what you define as young, first of all. I'd like to still define myself as young, but I think I'm probably pushing that now. I would say keep it as simple as possible. So generally, the earlier you can start saving for retirement, the easier it is. So one rule of thumb, which I've always liked, it's not scientific, obviously, but generally, if you take the age that you start contributing to a pension for the first time, divide it by two, and that's roughly what you should be aiming to save in order to generate a decent sized pot of money that will be able to provide you a decent income in retirement from broadly when the state pension age is. So roughly 66, that age is obviously going to go up. So if you think of someone who's aged 20, if they start saving today, then they might need to save 10% of their salary a year in order to provide that decent income in retirement. If they delay until age 30 to save, then they might need to set aside 15% of their income rather than 10% of their income in order to have the retirement that they might be looking for. Now, clearly, for lots of people, even 10% of your salary, even with matched contributions and tax relief, might feel like a step too far, particularly in a period of time where rents are going up significantly and inflation's going through the roof. I think that the main thing is to save what you can afford as early as you can, keep your charges as low as possible, and make sure you just get into that habit of saving regular and often and from as soon as possible. The earlier that you do it, the easier it'll be over the long run.
I just want to get on to annuities, which are linked to interest rates. When you get to retirement, you've got a couple of options. You can draw that pot down, or you can buy a guaranteed income stream, or you can actually do a mixture. So what I suppose quite a lot of people will do is buy an annuity stream, an income stream from an annuity to cover their costs, and then they might draw down the rest of their pot. So as interest rates have gone up, have annuities become more attractive when we've sort of since 2015 seen the drawdown option being really attractive because annuity rates were quite rubbish? Are they suddenly sort of jumping into life again?
Yeah, so that's been one of, I mean, I hesitate to say one of the positives that came from the mini budget. It was kind of it had a very short-lived life, didn't it? The mini budget that we saw, but yes, and throughout 2022, in fact, we've seen gilt yields. So that's essentially expectations of long-term interest rates have been going up, and when gilt yields go up, then annuity rates go up as well. And as you say, there's been a period post financial crash, really, when the Bank of England went on its quantitative easing binge. The annuity rates available to people who were converting their pension pot into retirement income have been in the doldrums. They've been incredibly low, historically low, for years and years and years. One of the benefits we've seen from gilt yields rising in recent weeks, and as I say, we saw that particularly dramatically in the wake of the mini budget, is that annuity rates have gone up as well. And it means that their annuities are going to be attractive, or at least an option to people, in a way that they perhaps just weren't an option, particularly, as you say, post 2015, when the pension freedoms and those extra flexibilities came into play. I think your point on taking a mix and match approach to retirement income is a really important one. I think too often when there are discussions around what you're going to do with your pot when you reach retirement, the discussion is, do you go into drawdown or do you buy an annuity? And there's not enough time spent thinking about the fact that actually, for lots of people, it will be a combination of the two that will work most effectively. Now, as you said, I think one of the ways that can work, and it will be more attractive at the moment than it has been in recent years, because annuity rates are more generous, is to use perhaps an annuity to cover your fixed costs, and then to keep some flexibility and to keep your money invested in drawdown and able to grow beyond those fixed costs. So that's one option. Another way that people tend to mix and match annuities and draw down is to opt for drawdown in the early years of retirement. So perhaps when they're younger and more active, having the flexibility of income might be more attractive to people. And then as you get older, and of course, as you get older, your annuity rate should, all else being equal, improve, partly because you are just older, and so your life expectancy will be lower from the insurance perspective. And it's also more likely that you'll develop certain life-limiting illnesses, which might mean that then you can get an even better rate from your insurance company. So sometimes slightly grim things to think about when you're thinking about when to buy an annuity in terms of the rate you get, because quite to be blunt, it's all about when or how likely it is from the insurance point of view that you are going to be at death's door from that point in time. But the longer you wait, the better rate you'll generally be able to get from your insurance company. So those are just a couple of ways that mixing and matching annuities and drawdown can work for people.
I just wanted to ask you've given some tips there around what we should do if we're a bit younger and sort of think about pension saving. Sometimes when we get sort of nearer retirement, let's say we're around 50 years old, then some people can think that it's too late to boost their pension pots. Would you are there any tips in order to that you might suggest to do that, to boost your pot?
I mean, the main way for people to increase the value of their retirement pot is to increase their contributions if they can do, and make the most, of course, of matched employer contributions, as well as the tax relief that you get. It may also be worth just having a quick review of your investment strategy as well. So make sure that it's an investment strategy you're happy with, remember that if you're in, say, your 50s and you're planning to go into drawdown, so you're planning to keep your money invested throughout retirement, then actually your investment time horizon is probably quite long. You might be talking about an investment time horizon of, 30 years or beyond. And so in those circumstances, you could have a decent amount of investment risk. Of course, you've got to be comfortable with that investment risk and make sure your charges are low and your fund is diversified and all the rest of it. But over history, generally, if you take more investment risk, then you'll have more of a chance for your pot to grow in value. One thing I think that people should be aware of, so increasing your contributions as you approach retirement will be the easiest way to boost the value of your pension pot. If you access taxable income from your pension flexibly, so if you and say if you're post 55, you enter drawdown and you take even 1 pound of taxable income from your pot, then the amount that you can save each year in a pension will fall from £40,000, that's the annual allowance, to just £4,000. So if you are a little bit older and you're planning to make significant top-ups to your contributions, then make sure that you don't take taxable income if you can possibly avoid it, because you'll really handicap your ability to make extra contributions after that point in time.
So that is the 75% portion of the pot that you would pay tax on. Okay. And just thinking practically, is it quite clear when you're sort of accessing that money in your pension, is it quite clear which bit of the portfolio is taxable versus the bit that you can take tax free and therefore
yes,
trigger that?
Yeah. Yes, it should be. So when you go through your platform or your provider or whomever it may be, so if your intention is just to take your tax-free cash, then it's possible to designate some or all indeed of your fund into drawdown and then take your tax-free cash, as long as you don't take the money out of drawdown, and so as long as it isn't subject to income tax, then you should be absolutely fine. You won't trigger the money purchase annual allowance. So that's reducing the annual allowance from £40,000 to £4,000. So you can take your tax-free cash and it won't have any impact. It's just if you withdraw even £1 of taxable income through drawdown, or if you take an ad hoc lump sum where it's taxable, that's where you'll trigger the money purchase annual allowance and you'll suffer a significant fall in the amount that you can save each year in a tax incentivized way.
Now, we've mentioned this mini budget, a bit of a disaster. Mm-hmm. I think there's a broad agreement on that. What we heard a lot in the press was that there were some pensions that had gotten into trouble to do with a specific type of strategy called LDIs. So do you want to explain what happened here with this particular issue?
Yeah, so I think it's now become law, hasn't it, to precede mini budget with the word disastrous, hasn't it? It's quite hard to describe it in any other way. And I think, it's not necessarily the thing that we all wanted the country to unite on, but I think most people of all viewpoints were united on the fact that it didn't go particularly well. So it was an interesting one. So the obviously during the mini budget, Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss made a series of pledges which didn't necessarily have the funding behind them, which scared investors in bond markets. So government bonds, just IOUs from the UK government. And so that became a problem because we saw a mass sell-off of those government bonds. So people, international investors, were less confident that the UK was a sound economy, a sound country to lend their money to. So they pulled their money out. And so we saw that the price of those government bonds, they're also called gilts, of course, which also confuses things a bit because we've got these different terms for the same thing. But government bonds, government gilts, the same thing. The price of them started to go down quite significantly because people were selling them off. So just a natural supply and demand interaction. Now, the reason that pensions got dragged into this really was because defined benefit pension funds often operate what's called, as you mentioned, a liability driven investment or LDI strategy. And now the way that these LDI strategies work is they're intended to hedge against the impact that gilt yield movements have on defined benefit pension liabilities. So broadly, when gilt yields go down, liabilities go up. And when gilt yields go up, liabilities go down. So you would have thought in the wake of the mini budget, gilt yields went up. That would mean that liabilities, so the amount that the defined benefit scheme thinks it's going to have to pay to its members, goes down. Normally, that would actually be a good thing for defined benefit pension schemes. And actually, we've seen since then that the funding position of lots of defined benefit pension schemes has improved. So the reason this became a problem that was linked to pensions was because these LDI strategies that hedge against those movements in gilt yields were demanding cash from those defined benefit pension schemes. So it's to be clear, if gilt yields had moved dramatically in the other direction, then the pension schemes would have been able to get a cash payout in effect from those LDI instruments. So it's just designed to cancel out the movements of gilt yields and the impact it has on the funding position of the defined benefit pension scheme. But because gilt yields moved so quickly, the LDI strategies and the investment banks running those LDI strategies were demanding huge amounts of cash now. And the kicker was that the defined benefit pension schemes were going to have to sell off some of their assets in order to pay those LDI strategies. And the main asset that most defined benefit pension funds invest in is UK government gilts. So we'd already seen post mini budget this threat of what was labelled a death spiral in the sale of UK government gilts. You've then got these quite complicated instruments held by defined benefit pension schemes, which were going to demand cash, and then they were going to have to sell off some of their assets, which would be government gilts, which would drive down the price of government gilts even further. And so the reason that the Bank of England intervened was to stop defined benefit pension schemes selling off even more gilts and causing further instability in the market for those government gilts. So it's quite complicated, yeah, quite involved, but it wasn't actually about people losing their pensions at all. It was about the way investments under the bonnet of defined benefits pension schemes work, and the fact that those DB schemes are big holders of government gilts. And so in the headlines we saw pensions and crisis, but actually it, in terms of members of DB schemes and certainly members of other types of pension schemes, so defined contribution schemes and your entitlement to the state pension, there was unlikely to be any material impact on people whatsoever. But unfortunately, lots of people were scared, I think, by those headlines. And I certainly spent quite a lot of time going around TV studios and doing radio phone-ins and things like that, trying to reassure people that actually, while those headlines are terrifying for some people, actually, for the vast majority of people, there's not going to be any impact on your pension pot in terms of people entitled to defined benefit pensions, provided the employer is there and is strong. Then that's legally the only thing that matters. If your employer goes under, then the pension protection fund provides you with a decent level of compensation beneath that. And as we discussed, in defined contribution pensions, generally most people will have their money invested in assets around the world, certainly when you're saving for retirement. And if you're invested heavily in bonds as you're approaching retirement, clearly that would have been a big problem. If you weren't intending to buy an annuity through one of these lifestyling funds, then there'll be people who've been significantly affected, but they would already have been wearing quite significant losses even before the mini budget hit.
Just moving on to even more recently than the mini budget, lots been going on recently. The autumn statement, we had some news for state pensioners, didn't we?
Yes. It feels like this year's lasted about 20 years, doesn't it? There has been quite a lot going on. So we had an autumn statement. So most of, certainly a lot of the big stuff about the autumn statement was actually announced before the autumn statement. So there was the unravelling of the vast majority of the mini budget measures. In terms of what that autumn statement looked like, I think for pensioners, certainly for retirees, it was generally quite good news. So there was some uncertainty about the state pension triple lock. So that's the government promise to increase the value of your state pension by the highest of average earnings, inflation, or 2.5%. Now, for the increase that was applied this year, the triple lock was abandoned because the earnings measure that was going to be used to increase the state pension was deemed to be too expensive, given that it's September's CPI inflation figure that's used for next year's increase, and that came in at just over 10%. Then I think there was some fairly reasonable concern that the government might do the same thing again, abandon the triple lock, but it stuck by the triple lock this time, which was, of course, a manifesto commitment. So that means that people in receipt of the state pension are now going to get a bumper 10.1% increase in their state incomes from April next year. So I think that's probably deemed as good news for those people in receipt of the state pension. There were some the usual rumours around pension tax relief. So the idea that potentially the Treasury would come in and scrap higher rate pension tax relief altogether, for example, and so introduce a flat rate of pension tax relief, possibly as low as 20%. That never materialised. And frankly, we get those rumours before almost every single major fiscal event, and every single time they turn out to be wrong. But who knows whether or not they'll come back again. I suspect they will. There was some talk of extending the freeze on the lifetime allowance, so the lifetime limit on the amount that you can build up in across all of your pensions. So that limit's been frozen at just over $1 million until the end of this parliament. There was talk of that was going to be extended by an extra 2 years, along with the big freeze that we've seen in income tax thresholds and other thresholds as well, in the event that's been left as it is. So in fact, in terms of solely the impact on pensions, actually we saw very little beyond what we already know.
Do you think the government are keen not to, you know, so you mentioned that they haven't done anything in terms of the tax relief, they're keeping that relatively generous. Do you think that's because they're sort of worried about the cost of us as a society getting a little bit older, and actually pension saving is something they really want to encourage rather than discourage?
Yeah, I'd like to think it's at least partly because the government concerned and thinking about the long term, because it's not, you know, necessarily the way of governments to think quite that far into the future. They usually look about as far as the end of their noses, which is usually a general election. I think being realistic, pension tax relief is too difficult a thing for them to get into, certainly at the moment, for short-term reasons rather than long-term reasons. So I think if you were to, for example, introduce a flat rate of pension tax relief, then there would be a question over how that would apply to defined benefit pensions, and in particular the impact that might have on public sector workers, who are the main people who continue to be in receipt of defined benefit pensions. So the net result of that would be effectively a tax increase being applied to doctors, nurses, anyone in the public sector who is in receipt of a defined benefit pension and gets tax relief at a higher rate than 20%, which would certainly be large, you know, swathes of doctors and things within the NHS. So I think that makes it too difficult. I also think that when you consider just the practicalities of a general election, we are getting sadly ever closer to another general election. And any government of any political party probably doesn't want to go into a general election looking to take away the benefits to people who do the right thing and save for retirement. So I'd like to think, as you say, it is a consideration of some of the long-term challenges that the UK faces, and the fact that the majority of people still aren't saving enough for retirement, and so people need to get all the help they can get. And luckily we still have that through the pension tax relief system, as well as through matched contributions, through workplace schemes and all the other tax incentives that exist. But I think it's probably more the cruel, brutal reality of politics and staying in power that's meaning that pension tax relief keeps being spared. But whatever way we get some sort of consistency and certainty for pensions, I guess is a good thing. So it should be welcomed.
Well, on that note, Tom Selby, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marcus.
Well, a very big thank you to Tom Selby there, and I think a really important topic, pensions, to finish off this season of interviews. We've upcoming for the sort of rest of December, really, we've got a couple of specials where we're going to be having a little look at some of the best bits from interviews over this particular season, just to round things off. And then in the new year, we're going to be starting fresh again with a new season of interviews and interviewees. So very much looking forward to that. I do hope you have a wonderful Christmas and a really good new year. And we'll see you in 2023. Until then, goodbye.